Live from Washington, this is Talk to America with Carol Pearson.
Do you feel that science has gathered more than an adequate amount of evidence that supports the theory of evolution? Eugenie Scott.
Oh, yes. The reason why scientists are so convinced that evolution took place is that it's supported by evidence from so many different fields, from physics to chemistry to biology to anthropology and many fields within.
Okay. Ken Ham.
Carol, I would say that scientific evidence definitely supports changes in living things, but it does not support at all the increase in information that's necessary for molecules to man evolution.
Today we're discussing the growing debate of the teaching of creation versus evolution, and my guests represent each side of the debate. Eugenie Scott is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education in Berkeley, California, and Ken Ham is the executive director of a group called Answers in Genesis. You can join us today if you call 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1, and the call is free if you live in a region where you can call us collect. And if you do, just ask your international operator to connect you with the United States and reverse the charges. If you'd like to participate but don't live in a region where you can call collect, call us. Make sure you give us your entire phone number, which would include your country code and your city code, as well as your local phone number. So join the debate. Let's talk about, and it seems pretty evident, Eugenie, that the National Center for Science Education, is that made up of scientists?
Our members are wide, very rangely across American society. Most of the members are scientists. We have a lot of members that are teachers. We have many members who are concerned about church-state separation issues because that's a component of the controversy. And our members range in their religious beliefs from atheists to evangelicals. We have every variety in there as well.
Ken, what about Answers in Genesis?
Answers in Genesis, Carol, consists of, we have people associated with us who are research scientists. We have some working full-time for us, some who work in their secular jobs as research scientists who contribute research for us. We have educators, all sorts of other professionals. And we, of course, have people who belong to your mainstream churches, who would be evangelical, born-again Christians. So we have, you know, a whole background of people involved in this particular organization.
Ken, is your difference with the theory of evolution one that only concerns humans, or do you disagree that other life forms evolved from early life forms?
Well, you know, really we're talking about the whole molecules to man idea here, and whether or not life has arisen by natural processes or whether there's supernatural involved. And so, you know, we're concerned with the whole formation of how life got here, where it came from in the first place. And, you know, if you take someone like, say, Richard Lewontin from Harvard University, who says, you know, he believes in molecules to man evolution because his a priori assumption is materialism. And he says you can't even allow a divine foot in the door. And so we recognize that this involves much more than just talking about molecules to man. It talks about your whole way of thinking. It talks about your whole worldview, because what you believe about where you came from, whether it's natural processes or supernatural, is certainly going to affect the way you view yourself and the way you view your fellow man.
But Ken, would you have a problem with, some of the beliefs that hold that you can believe in creationism, and also that there is actually no argument because what a human physical form evolved from is immaterial, and that what is important is when that physical form became man?
Well, what we're really talking about here is, do we believe in the creation account according to the Bible, or do we believe in some sort of creation account according to man's opinions? Because if you believe in the creation account according to the Bible, God took dust and made a man, took his side and made a woman, which is the whole basis, for instance, the doctrine of marriage. And not only that, the Bible teaches that death, bloodshed, diseases like cancer and so on are a consequence of sin, and degenerative things because of sin. in, the idea of millions of years and evolutionary processes of molecules to man, and you've got death and disease before Adam sinned, which actually destroys the whole basis of the Christian gospel. So it comes down to, you know, which God are you talking about here?
It also comes down to what interpretation of Christianity are you talking about? Because canon is associates and members of people who support his organization have one kind of Christian theology, that of special creation, like he described. God created everything all at one time, 6 days, and that death did not enter into the world until after the sin of Adam and Eve and so forth. I think it's important to note that that is not the only Christian interpretation, and that there are many individuals who are very strong in the Christian faith who disagree violently with both the science and the theology presented in Genesis.
You know, it's interesting that we're talking about the interpretation of Christianity when we're also discussing what how people interpret the first book of the Bible, Genesis, because, as I understand it, that first book is also accepted by people of the Jewish faith.
And Muslims.
Yes. So where are they involved in this debate at all?
Again, it's the same. It's a very similar division. There are literalists, Quranic literalists, Muslims, and Torah literalists, Jews, as well as Christian biblical literalists. If your theology requires you to take your sacred documents as being literally true, then you are going to have a problem with evolution. And in Israel, for example, there is a strong anti-evolution movement.
You know, Carol, it's interesting, when you look in the New Testament, Jesus Christ, who, of course, you know, when you talk about Christianity, you're talking about him as the one who created all things, who's the Word, who's the truth, who's the Savior of mankind. He, for instance, when he was asked about marriage, quoted from Genesis and quoted it as literal history, and that's the whole basis for marriage. I mean, if Genesis is not literal history, then I would like someone to explain to me why Jesus is called the last Adam.
Question I have about what you're talking, it sounds like what you're talking about is only a Christian point of view, that it doesn't allow for, you know, points of people who don't accept the Bible for their source of inspiration or as the Word of God.
Well, there you come to, I guess, an important point, Carol, and that is this. For instance, does Eugenie Scott's group allow for our particular view of the Bible, which is taking it as it's written, taking it as, for instance, Genesis as literal history? And I think what we're also talking about is this. I mean, there are all sorts of groups out there with all sorts of different views of, about origins. But when we're talking about the Bible and talking about Genesis, talking about Christianity here, we're talking about something that connects to reality and is there to connect to the fossils and to dinosaurs and to the trees and why there's death and suffering in the world. And it's a whole system. It's not, we're not just talking about different views of origins. We're talking about connecting it to the real world.
Well, I know that the push at Answers in Genesis, as well as the other creation science organizations in the United States, the Institute for Creation Research, is to try to tie in a special creation theological view with science. That is why they call themselves proponents of creation science. The science of creationism has been evaluated by scientists and shown to be extremely poorly supported. But actually, I think it's very useful for us to have had this initial discussion because I think it helps your listeners and callers to understand that fundamentally there is a religious foundation to this anti-evolution movement. Mr. Ham referred to Richard Lewontin, an evolutionary biologist, who is very strong in his philosophical, naturalistic point of view. He's a non-believer, and he's actually a proponent of non-belief. It is immaterial what Richard Lewontin's philosophical views are. I take exception to Mr. Ham's point of view there, because there are evolutionists who accept, who are theists, who accept that God just chose the process of evolution to bring about his purpose. There are evolutionists who are, like myself and Richard Lewontin, who are non-believers, and we both look at the scientific evidence exactly the same. We will look at the scientific evidence very, very differently from how the people in Ken Ham's organization will look at it. One very good example is that they hold the position that the Earth is only about 10,000 years old. This is not a point of view you're going to be found being taught in any college or university in the United States, and that includes Baptist institutions like Baylor or Brigham Young, which is a Mormon institution up in Utah.
Well, let's talk about what role evolution should play in a curriculum, or not for that matter, creationism should play in a school's curriculum when we get back. My guests are Eugenie Scott. She's the executive director of the National Center for Science Education in Berkeley, California, and Ken Ham, the executive director of a group called Answers in Genesis. Our phone number is 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. This is Talk to America.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders pledged a fresh start to the Middle East peace process recently by reaffirming agreements in the Y River Accord. Also, in a landmark decision, the Israeli Supreme Court outlawed the systematic use of torture, including sleep deprivation, violent shaking, and other physical abuse of Palestinians under interrogation. Politicians say the decision weakens the country's ability to thwart terrorist attacks. These are just some of the current issues going on in the Middle East. And Tuesday on Talk to America, we've assembled a group of experts to discuss these and other issues.
We invite your thoughts on the Middle East, so get your comments ready and give us a call. Remember to make it collect at edges. See what topics are ahead by visiting our webpage. And be sure to join us Tuesday at 17 hours Universal Time for Talk to America.
Pick up your phone and call us collect at 202-619-3111 and join us on Talk to America. Here again is Carol Pearson.
Once again, my guests are Eugenie Scott, the executive director of the National Center for Science Education in California, and Ken Ham, the executive director of Answers in Genesis. Let's go to the phones and to Matthew in Liberia. Go ahead, Matthew. What's your question?
Yes, I have two major questions here at the moment. First, I would like Ms. Eugenie Scott, if I'm right, to please explain to me the unicellular stage of her theory of evolution. That is where there was this one cell organism, you know, evolving from nowhere and just developing into plants and animals. And then my second question has to do with how will she compromise the evolution theory with observation? Because observation is supposed to form a major part of what is known as the scientific method.
Let me deal with your last question first, Matthew, because I think it's a very important one. The accusation is often made that because evolution cannot be directly observed, it's not a scientific topic. Of course, there are many phenomena in nature that we try to study scientifically, and for a variety of reasons, we cannot directly observe all of them. Astronomy, for example, has phenomena, galaxies that are so far away that we can't see them directly. We can only measure them indirectly. There are, in particle physics and other areas of the physical sciences, structures that are too small to be directly observed. So what has grown up since the discovery of the method of science several hundred years ago are a variety of research designs that allow us to test our explanations indirectly. Observation is not as important as testing. And here, quite frankly, is where the creation science argument falls down, because when their arguments are tested against the natural world, they fail. Now, your first question, I'm very pleased that you asked your first question about what actually is evolution, because many people are confused by two things: the origin of life from natural cause and what happens after that life existed. The origin of life is a very interesting research topic that many scientists are working on. Like all aspects of science, we are trying to explain the origin of life, like everything else, using natural processes. We don't have an agreement, a consensus among scientists as to how life began. Nonetheless, there's a lot of research, and there are some things about which consensus is forming. But it's very, very fair to say that we don't know yet how life formed. Now, does that disprove evolution? No. because evolution has to do with the big idea that living things shared common ancestors in the past, and in Darwin's term, descended with modification from common ancestors. You have to have something that can change through time before you can have evolution. So how life began, whether through natural cause, as we're trying to discover, whether God worked through natural cause to produce the first replicating molecule, or whether God created the first replicating molecule de novo, are ideas that, you know, we certainly can't answer scientifically. But however life began, what happened after that? Now, Mr. Ham's position is that God created everything.
Well, let's let Mr. Ham, let's let Mr. Ham explain.
Our position in evolution
let me respond to that, Carol. First of all, when Eugenie is talking about particle physics and so on, not being able to observe it directly, indirect observation, I mean, she's quite correct about that, but they're things we are experimenting with in the present. And that's a little different when we're talking about the origin of life supposedly millions of years ago, when we can't repeat that and it's happened in the past. I mean, that's something totally different. She should see that there's a difference there. But the question I've got for Eugenie is this. You can talk all you want about things in the past and about the big picture, etc. But if evolution, if the process of molecules to man evolution is true, then you've got to be able to give me an example where we see an increase in information. And we see in real science in the present that information is able to arise from matter by itself. And that's what we don't see. There is no observed example of such.
Of course, I'm always amused at when people when opponents of evolution, like Ken or others, describe evolution as molecules to man. I mean, you could talk about molecules to warthogs or molecules to pine trees. I mean, what's this? Why is there this idea that somehow there was this march through time from the first replicating molecule to our own species? The whole understanding of evolution that scientists have, as opposed to critics of evolution have, is that life is a big lattice or a big net.
Ken, before we've got a number of calls coming in, so I'd like to get to them.
Right.
But before we go on, I just want to ask you one question,
uh-huh.
And that is, how old would you say that the Earth is?
I would say that because every dating method we have is based on assumptions, and 90% of all age dating methods you use get dates younger than evolutionists require. Because there's a lot of anomalous dates. When I add up all the dates in the Bible, I do only get thousands of years, and I do believe that what we see is consistent with what the Bible teaches.
So you don't accept carbon dating or anything like that?
Well, carbon dating has nothing to do with the age of the Earth anyway. It has nothing to do with
the
general idea of radiometric dating is what you mean.
Right. You don't accept that, for instance, in the Smithsonian Museum here in Washington, you have fossils of dinosaurs, and you would say that the Smithsonian's account of how old these fossils are is erroneous.
Oh yeah, I would say that. And see, it's like recently scientists found out with potassium argon dating, there's an excess of argon in the mantle, and so when you get a lava flow forming, it will date to millions of years old, and they know that dating method has some major problems. These are the sorts of things the public isn't aware of, and Eugenie doesn't want the public to find out about. But I would still like Eugenie to answer the question. Can you give me an example of an increase in information from matter to substantiate your idea of evolution?
Well, Eugenie, I'm going to ask you to give that answer later. I'd like to get Samket in India on the line. Samket, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask, as we know that evolution occurred as Dryopithecus, then Australopithecus, Homo habilis, then Homo erectus, then Homo sapiens. Then the later species exist when the previous one was still there. And if not, then one species must have been disappeared, giving rise to the next species. And if so, then I think this supports evolution.
Okay, I think one of the misunderstandings many people have about evolution is that an entire species has to evolve into a new species for evolution to have taken place. Actually, that's not the case. That's one way that perhaps some species do evolve if they're rather small and not very geographically widespread. But a much more common way that evolution is likely to have occurred, and which we can see operating in present-day species, is for populations that are off on the edge of the range of the species to be cut off by the various natural forces, river changes, stream, or something like that. And they are no longer in genetic contact with the parent species, and over time this group of populations, or this peripheral group, does change enough so that it can't interbreed with the main population. Now, if that is the way speciation and evolution occur, and that certainly is the best understanding that we have today, then you could indeed have a species that gave rise to another species coexisting with it.
Let's get Ken's take on this. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, one of the things that we have to come to agreement here is that creationists have no problem with speciation. No problem at all. In fact, there are times when species get to the stage where they can't interbreed anymore, but that's due to a loss of information. In fact, over a period of time, natural selection, genetic drift, jumping genes, the processes that we see operating in science, in the real world, which creationists agree with, result in speciation, but speciation results in a loss of information. In fact, Lee Spector, who is a fellow at Johns Hopkins University, in his book Not by Chance, admits that even every point mutation that's ever been observed results in a reduction of information overall. And
well, that's
so,
nonsense, Ken.
I'm sorry, that's not nonsense. That's real science.
I know creationists for the last, couple of years have been pushing this information theory buzzword. And geneticists look at these arguments and they say, what are these people talking about? This is absolutely nuts.
Okay, you say it's nuts. You say it's nonsense.
Well,
Give me an example.
Okay, you tell me what you mean by information, because that is a very mystic word.
You're trying to get around the
problem. Well, I'm not.
The information system in our cells that read our DNA, the information that communicates to the building of the biological machinery and so on. Give me an example, for instance, in our genes, in our DNA. Give me an example of new information added into the genes that could produce feathers, whereas feathers previously didn't exist. Give me an example of matter.
I've got a question for both of you. Would this debate even matter to either of you if it were not for the way this topic is presented in schools, especially elementary schools and universities?
Carol, a couple of things there. One is, the more we take children in the education system, as Eugenie and her group, NCSE, who, by the way, have many connections to humanist groups around the world. If you look up their website, you'll see what their real agenda is on.
We also connect to your group.
You
don't connect us, though.
I didn't get the Humanist of the Year award in 1998 either, Eugenie.
Neither did NCSE. That was personal.
You do have many connections to the humanist
group. But is it the education aspect that makes this such an important debate?
It is, because if you take a whole generation through an education system, you teach them there's no God, you're a result of natural processes, there is ultimately no basis for right or wrong, no basis for morality, regardless of what you do.
You said earlier, Carol, that we would be agreeing and disagreeing. Ken, I'm with you here. We should not be teaching kids in our schools that God does not exist. And I will stand linking arms with you against any teacher that says this. However, I think that it is a very sincerely held fear that students are taught evolution, they are taught that they have to take their religion and chuck it. I think that this is something that is greatly overstated. I deal a lot with K-12, kindergarten to 12th grade teachers in this country. They are very highly religious. They have the same percentages of belief as the rest of the American nation. And I have not found anybody who gets up there and says, you should give up your religion because of evolution. I think this is an overstated fear.
You know what? When we come back, we have to take a short break. But when we come back, I would like to know what place would this, for instance, the Hindu theory of the creation of the world, or the Buddhist theory of the creation of the world, or for that matter, the American Crow-Indian theory of creation, have, what role would that play in the way the theories of evolution or creation are taught in our schools? Is there a place for them? I'd like to hear from you today. Whether you have a question or an opinion, the number is 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. Call collect tomorrow, we're going to talk about the chances for peace in the Middle East. We're going to take a short break for the news with David Kohler, and then we'll be back to talk more about creationism versus evolution. I'm Carol Pearson.
Welcome back to Talk to America. Our number is 202-619-3111. Again, here's Carol Pearson.
Today we're talking about the growing debate over teaching our children, what we teach our children regarding the creation of Earth and mankind. My guests are Eugenie Scott. She's the executive director of the National Center for Science Education in Berkeley, California. Also, Ken Ham, the executive director of a group called Answers in Genesis. As always, your questions and comments are welcome, and for to call 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. Place the call through your international operator and make it collect. Let's get back to the phones to Seoul in South Africa. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is an old debate. It's like the abortion debate. Sometimes I don't think either side is listening to the other. But I'd just like to ask this question of Mr. Ham. Do you believe that God overrides the principles of the laws of physics, biology, and chemistry in the area of creation, or do you not every day live by those rules when you open your refrigerator, when you do any number of things? How is it that the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology apply to everything else but not to creation?
I'm not sure what your exact question is there, because certainly I believe in the laws of physics, biology, and chemistry, and certainly God set up those laws. I mean, he can overrule them if he wants, but in this everyday world, we live according to the laws that God made, and that's what we as creationists are saying. When you look at the real world, when we look at DNA, when we look at the information systems, when we look at natural selection, when we look at species, this is all happening according to the laws that God set up, and so we have no problem with that.
But it sounds like you don't accept the scientific research in astronomy or geology or in a number of other sciences.
No, Carol, there's a big difference between what we observe in the present and our interpretations to connect the present to the past. And you see, that's something that we need to distinguish here. And that is, with creation, yes, there are belief aspects. We have revealed to us that God tells us that he made distinct kinds of animals and plants and so on. There's been a global flood. I can't scientifically prove those things. But there are also observational aspects in the present. We can observe fossils. We can observe living things change. And the same with evolution. Evolution has scientific aspects. They look at natural selection too. They look at mutations too. But then they're also talking about processes that happened in the past, which they don't have in the present as well. And so you've got to distinguish between what we're really observing as scientists, what's happening right now before us, and our belief aspects about the past. And they're two different things.
Let's get back to Sowell, please.
Make one more point. This really reduces down to one very simple question, and it was asked before. To just say that the world is a certain number of years old and that you don't accept carbon dating, to me, it flies in the face of science, logic, and the Bible.
Can I ask you a question?
Do you believe the Bishop of Usher was right that the world is only about 4,004 years old?
Well, Bishop Usher didn't Bishop Usher didn't say 4,004 years old.
But it's not more than 10,000 years old.
Bishop Usher would be about 6,000 years old, which I would basically agree with from the scriptures. But you mentioned carbon dating there, which has nothing to do with the millions of years, by the way. And if you're talking about real science, what's that?
Okay, now radiometric dating is, you know, let's not get into triviality.
Theologically
and scientifically,
this is a real
carbon dating is based on the emission of various types of particles and radiation.
Carol, this is a very important point.
It has nothing to do with it.
It's a very important point. This person is talking about carbon dating and accusing me of or science, but carbon dating has nothing to do with millions of years.
How about radioactive dating? Okay, you have a problem with that then.
Well, all radioactive dating methods are based on assumptions, aren't they?
Aren't they based on assumptions? Of course, just like everything else in science.
So they're not, you can't say they're absolutely absolute, right?
No, I'm saying that they are exceedingly consistent, and there are so many different isotopes of different elements that decay at regular rates that we can make those assumptions very safely. Now, let's not get distracted with whether carbon-14 is free for one time period or another. There are a number of radioactive isotopes that have that all cluster very, very well around the idea that the Earth is about 4.8 billion years old.
But the other thing, too, Eugenie, is that there are many age dating methods. And even the radiometric dates, you get all sorts of anomalous dates, and we could give examples of those, but there are...
Sure you do, because...
Well, you know what?
The whole nature of the science performed by the creation scientists is anomaly mongering. You sift through the scientific data, pull out the pieces that don't seem to support the general consensus view and wave them around and say, aha, see, evolution didn't take place.
So you do agree that there are evidences that do conflict with what you're saying.
We'll get back to this. Let's hear, Sowell might be interested in hearing what another person from South Africa has to ask. Jane, go ahead, please.
Good evening. You know, Carol, I find this debate particularly intriguing because it seems it emanates from a country like yours, which basically took humankind to the moon. I listened to Ken, who I gather from his accent must be an Australian, so I sincerely hope that whatever legal case you have actually goes more Eugenie's way. But I have several things I'd like to ask him. From listening to him, I'm curious to know these scientists that he draws from. Do these include anatomists and physicists and geologists?
Absolutely.
Are there many of them?
Biologists, actually.
See, that's the other thing that we have to understand is that there are creation scientists, and what I mean by that is scientists who publish in the secular field, who work in the secular field, in various disciplines who are ardent creationists.
But what side do the bulk of scientists come down on? Do they side in with creationists or evolutionists?
Oh, that's easy. The majority of scientists side in with evolution. That's true, but that doesn't mean that they're right.
This is true.
Then you're actually contradicting yourself, Ken, because you're saying that your decision has been supported by science, you know, the few paragraphs in the Bible. And what absolutely amazes me about this description in the Bible, too, and it seems to threaten you, science seems to threaten your belief. I mean, why should an infinite, omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent creature restrict itself to a mythical garden?
You know what? It's not a matter of an omnipotent being restricted. It's a matter of I'm restricted to letting that omnipotent being tell me what he did. And if the Bible is his revelation...
But you believe literally what it says, so you must obviously, you know, you're taking a few paragraphs, and generally I don't know what particular translation of the Bible your particular sect relies on, but I know with great certainty that the King James Bible has been mistranslated, and the description that is given of the Garden of Eden by those translators and is entirely at odds with the Hebrew translation. So you rely from the outset on a mistranslated text.
Well, I'm not relying on any mistranslated text. And in fact,
well, what particular text are you relying on?
Well, when we study the scriptures, we go back to the original language. We look at the original Hebrew.
So you speak Hebrew?
I don't speak Hebrew, but I have people who are Hebrew experts who go through and explain it to me. By the way, the interesting thing is, if you take the Bible as a whole, the book of Genesis in the first 11 chapters are quoted from, referred to more than any other book in the entire Bible, and particularly in the New Testament by writers like Paul and Jesus Christ himself quotes from it. And they all quote from it as history. So internally...
But the way... But the way you rationalize, then you would take something like, this is my body and this is my blood. That's, this concept of transubstantiation, or I'm not sure what your particular sect believes in, whether you believe in consubstantialism and or Unitarianism.
Well, I think it's very simple.
The reason why I ask you is because you say that this idea of incarnation, which is essentially what evolution is about, it's looking at ourselves as the carnal creatures that we are. And your idea about God is so limiting. I can't see why it's not more inspiring to imagine that our transition from whatever was far more complex than something that happens in five paragraphs.
If that's the God you're talking about, it is a horrible, vindictive, and a disease-ridden God, because the violent disease universe that we see right now before us, and all the death and struggle we see before us, if that's my God, then I wouldn't want to worship that God. But the God of the Bible is the God who made a perfect world, and that death is an enemy, death is an intrusion. And so you see, I don't worship God. He's a holy God. He gave Adam and Eve the choice. He didn't make them to be puppets. He wanted them to love him because they wanted to love him, and instead they rebelled against him. And so, because of man's sin, man
has
no right to
even live. We did put that up in five paragraphs. It never
came anywhere. Jane, thank you very much for asking provocative questions. We're going to hear some more, too. Kimba in Finland has a question. Go ahead, Kimba.
Yes, I would like to ask, I'm sorry I didn't get her name, but...
Eugenie.
Yes, Jeannie. So, Jeannie, what is the highest level of organism where you have observed, or scientists have observed, hard proof of beneficial mutation? Because I understand evolution relies on beneficial mutations.
There are, if you look at the genetic variation within, say, an enzyme system of one species, let's say rats, and you look at the enzyme system for that, the genetic system for the same enzyme, the same protein, in a closely related species, you will find that they are, generally speaking, very similar, but they're not identical. There will be different, slight differences in position or particular amino acids, et cetera, not to get too technical, but there will be differences between them. Now, this enzyme operates exactly the same way in both the rat species and the mouse species. But there was a mutation that caused a difference between the two. Although the enzyme works just fine, it does the same process in whatever aspect of the cell that it operates. The point being here is that the majority of mutations that take place in biological systems and genetics are benign. They are duplications, they are redundancies, and it is only during the process of time that the ones that are disadvantageous get weeded out, and the occasional one that really provides a surprising advantage are retained. Now, the only way that you could reconstruct that as to which are the advantageous ones would be to do a very close taxonomy, as it were, of the same enzyme cross-related species, and then you get into more distantly related species. And that might be mildly interesting, but it's probably not going to really help us understand genetics any better. So basically, scientists haven't really worried about that. It's pretty much the creationist community that has gotten all exercised about this idea that mutations are only bad and that you can't explain evolution.
Eugenie,
the variation that natural selection works upon.
Eugenie, that's a misrepresentation of the creationist view, because nowhere in my writings would I say that mutations are only bad. In fact, there are beneficial mutations, and I could list some for you right now if you really wanted some beneficial mutations. But,
well, we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have one, we'll hear one caller's view of what happened in a moment. We're talking about creationism versus evolution. Our telephone number is 202-619-3111. We'll have more after this. This is Talk to America.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders pledged a fresh start to the Middle East peace process recently by reaffirming agreements in the Y River Accord. Also, in a landmark decision, the Israeli Supreme Court outlawed the systematic use of torture, including sleep deprivation, violent shaking, and other physical abuse of Palestinians under interrogation. Politicians say the decision weakens the country's ability to thwart terrorist attacks. These are just some of the current issues going on in the Middle East. And Tuesday on Talk to America, we've assembled a group of experts to discuss these and other issues.
We invite your thoughts on the Middle East, so get your comments ready and give us a call. Remember to make it collect and we'll pay the charges. See what topics are ahead by visiting our webpage. And be sure to join us Tuesday at 17 hours Universal Time for Talk to America. Pick up your phone and call us collect at 202-619-3111 and join us on Talk to America. Here again is Carol Pearson.
And my guests today are Eugenie Scott and Ken Ham. Let's go back to the phones and to Jasmine in South Africa. Good evening, Jasmine. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good evening. I want to just answer Ken, if I'm spelling, I'm pronouncing the name all right. I understand that you said nobody knows where that began, and that is true, because that was God's secret. Because if God has revealed to man to know how to create another man, I'm telling you, we should have a disaster. And to be honest with you, when a man, all what you are doing today, we are doing God's image. And when a man, I want to respect the science. The science, because when a man studies a science, he studies God's mind. You understand that? Because the way, if you can see what you are doing today, you see the flammable aeroplane, see the cars, everything, because God was built a cow when we can fight with a cow or with a donkey. So we decided to do it faster thing than the way we are killing ourselves. So now, as I'm saying to you, that it's not just a matter of revolution, it's God's creation. And no man can take it away from that. It's only God never gave that to man to know that how to create another man. And let me tell you another thing which you don't know. The only three men which was born was created by God once. The first man, it was a black man. The second was an Indian. The last man, which was at the end of the day, God was finished with a white man. So in that sense, I've listened all the conversation, so I can join there and there, but I tell you one thing, nobody knows. No man will know. And if you can go and find out, you won't find any way that how to man create a man.
Can I just say something here? And that is, I'm sure even Eugenie might, I don't know, she might agree with me on this one. She might agree with my biblical framework of the Tower of Babel and so on. But, you know, there is really no problem in understanding what different people groups and why we have black skin and so on, all going back to one man, because every human being has the same skin color. It's a matter of how much or how little you have. And if you split up a population, and the Bible talks about the Tower of Babel, you can actually explain the different people groups. And it's a similar process to natural selection that we observe in the animal world, that we can apply even to the humankind, and we can understand the different people groups, because we are all one. We all do go back to Adam and Eve. And you see, that was another point, is the fact that, don't get the idea that creationists are against science. We love science. We believe in real science. In fact, talking about beneficial mutations, like I was talking about before, is real science. But we have to be honest and say, beneficial mutations, though, are not an increase in information. That's a little different to what the evolutionists require for their molecules to man idea.
Let's go to Dmitry in Russia. Dmitry, go ahead, please.
I believe that evolution can take place inside species, but not between species. Maybe in future all men become black or white, but Mikey never can become man. And genetics has proved that very well. And I cannot understand this discussion. Nobody sees that one species has given other species, not in life, not in laboratory. Of course, Bible is right.
Okay.
Well, actually, I think Ken and I, Ken just agreed with me. It's nice that we have some things we can agree on, Ken, that speciation does take place, and it has been observed in nature and in the laboratory as well. You can get new species that are incapable of exchanging genes with the parent species. But I think the difference here between, and here's where we have to disagree, is that I would find that this process extended over a very, very long period of time could result in the diversity of plants and animals that we have today. Ken doesn't believe the Earth is very old, so obviously this process would not be able to produce the variety of species today. But more to the point, his view is that God created the kinds of animals in their present form. I wonder
We're running out of time, so even though Dimitri has other comments, I won't get back to him, but I did want to ask the question. The reason this debate is so important in the United States is because it affects what's presented in public schools. So should we have a course called The Theories in Evolution, of Evolution or Creation of Man, in which we present all theories of either creation or evolution of man, including those, we have many Americans who are Baha'is, we have many Americans who are Hindus, we have many Americans who are Buddhists, and we have many Native Americans. Ken?
Carol? Okay. I would say this. If you have Buddhists, Hindus, and others who do have a whole model of explaining, you know, speciation and the fossils and dinosaurs and so on, then, yes, students should be allowed to hear that.
But otherwise, we're just presenting what is a Christian point of view for people who may not be Christian.
Well, my point is this. I've never seen a Buddhist view or a Hindu view that actually explains fossils and dinosaurs.
That's according to you, but they certainly have Native Americans certainly have a very logical explanation for how man came to be.
It differs from one tribe to another.
But they do have
Ken, are you perhaps arguing that they don't have scientific evidence for their position?
No, what I'm saying is they don't really have a complete worldview involving connecting everything to, as I said, fossils, to death and suffering.
But is that elitism, Ken? Is that elitism? I think they do. Let's hear from Pat in Zimbabwe, our last caller. Pat, go ahead.
Yes, Carol. Just one point, you know, I am a Christian and I believe my Bible, but I'm not going to limit God. The Bible says that with God, a day is as 1,000 years, 1,000 years as a day. God is not governed by time. I find no conflict between creation or evolution because God could have done it that way.
Well,
so what is the argument about?
God actually tells us how he did it. He said he made everything in 6 days. And he said
but 6 days, according to Pat, could be 6,000 years or more.
But Pat, that doesn't work because you can't use a phrase from the New Testament to determine the meaning of a Hebrew word in Genesis.
The New Testament also the inspired word of God?
Yeah, but the day is like 1,000 years is not defining the word day. I mean, if you're going to do that, Pat, you've got to do it with every time you use the word day in the Old Testament.
Well, that's true. Maybe you have to do it. What do you say about that, Ken?
Listen, the reason we're communicating, hopefully, is because we have a language convention and words have meaning in context. And a Hebrew language, the words have meaning in context.
Is the New Testament not the inspired word of God?
Absolutely. But a day like 1,000 years...
But then maybe that was an explanation, a further explanation of what day means. To reject one or the other.
It's
sounds like you can't take both.
The word day is defined in the Hebrew language by the Hebrew word. A phrase in the New Testament is talking about the concept God's outside of time. That is not defining the word day.
Well, Eugenie Scott and Ken Ham, thank you very much for a very stimulating conversation. Eugenie Scott is the executive director of the National Center for Science Education in Berkeley, California. And Ken Ham is the executive director of the Answers in Genesis. Tomorrow we'll talk about the chances for peace in the Middle East. I'm Carol Pearson. Join me again tomorrow at 17 hours Universal Time for Talk to America.